Hello all, welcome to the God Said to Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged literature. We're going to be releasing our first book of 2020 called The Sodomites. More information will follow. I'm still working on the book cover, so I'm still speaking with the author. So there's a little bit of a ways to go, but it's gonna be announced on the website soon. Just thought I'd keep you guys apprised for those of you who do care. You can also go to our website, check out the five other books we published, all of which are free as a statement against commodification. And yeah, so that's Kai Draconis Books. Today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about John Milton's Paradise Lost, which Chris and I were chatting briefly beforehand, trying to determine how we're going to approach it, because I'm not sure. Nobody here is a poetry expert, though I do love epic poetry. You know, Homer is without a doubt my favorite poet, but that being said, you know, Paradise Lost is probably is super difficult. Is all I'm going to say. So yeah. I don't know where. I forgot to mention with me as always are the other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. So how do you want to go into this, gents?
Can I start by making an observation that I sent you guys a message saying that this felt like Fast and the Furious, but written. And Christian fan fiction. And I think I was only a few chapters in when I made that comment. But I do kind of want to say that, like, Milton could write a set piece, like a visual sort of, like a physical, like some of the things that are happening here. And I kind of felt like, story-wise, I was very interested in, I mean, should we summarize the story? I mean, like it's sure, Paradise yeah. Lost. What's that?
Yeah, we can summarize it.
Satan and the band One Third of Heaven that rises up against God are cast out.
Hail Satan.
And they're all pretty bummed, you know, they're all in hell and it sucks and it's boring and it isn't heaven anymore. He tells them that he's heard stories about another world with other creatures made by God in his image, mankind. And I think like his motivations are pretty interesting. Maybe something we could talk about. But basically, he's going to go and mess with Adam and Eve, and he convinces Eve to eat of the tree of knowledge, who convinces Adam to eat of the tree of knowledge. Satan goes back to hell and he's all like, hey, yeah, I kicked ass up there. And then he and all the other demons, or I guess fallen angels, are turned into serpents. Adam and Eve, now they know good and evil, and so they fuck, because that requires a knowledge of good and evil. They get a good fuck on, and then they argue, because, you know, and then they feel guilty about it, and God comes. I think for me, another thing that I found interesting, so two of the kind of character beats that I found interesting were Satan's motivations, how they kind of like are sort of constructed. I felt like the most interesting thing was basically the commiseration scene, or the commiseration following Adam and Eve realizing that they're going to die and that they're going to be punished, and that they're probably going to go to hell, and that all of their kids are going to, you know, be cursed for their crime against God, and probably they'll all go to hell too. But I found that scene was really interesting, where they kind of choose to carry on. That was like the most human moment for me. Maybe it's supposed to be. They're kicked out of the Garden of Eden, but there is this kind of glimmer of hope created for them in the form of Jesus. And I just want the first few books I found to be extraordinarily boring in terms of like character, like, and sort of like the story, but also amazing in terms of like just the scenes being depicted. Like, it felt like I was watching, that's where kind of the Fast and Furious is the wrong way of putting it. It was like a Guillermo del Toro, like how Milton creates a physicality and a kind of a scene, you know, to portray what is, you know, like, I guess my understanding is probably hadn't been sort of described as viscerally, but his descriptions of like the fallen angels heaped, I think, like feathers, you know, like in like in hell, and like their bodies, like I felt like I was watching, like, that's kind of where the Fast and the Furious thing came from, these like ripped, you know, sort of angels, like just striding around, like talking about like what they're gonna do to get back at God, and the battle and everything like that. It's actually like, it felt like something that, it feels like Milton's power was actually visualizing these things to me. That was my impression. And with a few dips into some very interesting philosophical like questions and sort of debates, and for the most part, not very interesting to me characters. But I don't, like, does that give you guys anything to kind of latch on to? I wonder if it's sort of like the biopic problem, where like biopics are sort of boring because like you can't twist the story. Like, he didn't have control over the story. He just was telling what happened. But I don't know, like, does anything in there kind of like give either of you something to latch on to?
I would like to respond to your, you said that like the first few books are not as entertaining to you. And I actually find that I really enjoy the first few books. One, because I think Satan is the most interesting character, and he's featured prominently in the first few books, along with his retinue of fallen angels. And also it's in these first few books where Milton is most explicitly responding to the Iliad. So I don't know if you guys have read the Iliad or are familiar with it, but there's a portion in it where all the Greek troops and their commanders and generals and whatnot are kind of introduced. And in the Iliad, it is kind of super boring, like, because it's like a whole book, like 30 or 40 pages or more of just, you know, descriptions of the Achaean troops, so Agamemnon and Menelaus, the Myrmidons under Achilles, and, you know, the Ithacans under Odysseus, and you know, all the other less famous troops. And we've got a reflection of that in this book here, where we go through each one of the fallen angels and we explain who they are, and I think it's cool because, one, it's a response to the Iliad. It's like giving like paying some homage to the Iliad, but also I think it's super cool to just see like these.
They're rad. They're described super rad. Like, the descriptions are amazing.
They are amazing.
But isn't it kind of like, so was it practice to sort of, because some of these are like pagan gods. Like they're like, I think that there are some Egyptian gods in there, right? Like,
Oh yeah.
so was that already being done, or did Milton just Google back in the 1600s? Did you just Google a bunch of like pagan gods and be like, yeah, and then this one? Because it really felt to me, not knowing enough about the history, perhaps, like a kind of contemporary like Hollywood film where like it's like, yeah, we're just gonna throw a bunch of gods in there. Like, you know, like we're just gonna grab them from different, you know, like, and let's get the Ethiopian god of the swamp, and like,
Well,
and he's got a loincloth and he's super
or it'd be
ripped and he's mad, you know.
like in like a Guy Ritchie movie or something like that, like a Guy Ritchie movie or in like in The Irishman, where like you have a character and it like freeze frames and there's a little caption that like talks about like where that guy
Yeah.
ended up. It would be like
How they
there's a
die.
demon talking and then freeze frame, convince the Assyrians to worship him as Pazuzu, right? Like.
Exactly. No, that's exactly it. There was something, and I couldn't, I was really kind of, I dug it, but it also sort of like, I couldn't, that was part of what made me think of this as like is Milton, like his treatment of, I did not find Satan very interesting, except when he was watching Adam and Eve, like toward the middle, when he was sort of when he was sort of, you know, how awful goodness is right around there, like his like thinking about like his own motivations. I didn't really like he just felt like a, like, I don't know, it felt like a very simple character arc to me at the beginning, of a very simple character being cast out of where he thought he belonged, you know, not, you know, wanting to get that back, wanting to get back at God. I don't know, but all of the stuff around it, all of the like, all of the set pieces, all of the interesting like the description of he meets this figure when he is basically on his way through chaos to the Garden of Eden. All of that was really interesting. I'm talking too much, but I didn't, I wasn't really like, what did you like about Satan as a character?
I mean, he's like, fuck God. Like, God is a fucking tyrant. I mean, seriously. Seriously, like, Adam and Eve are condemned to, like, a miserable fucking existence for disobeying him. And you know, like, and this is something that I wanted to bring up, and it's something that Christians really have to deal with. Like, they have to deal with the origin of morality in one of two ways. So they either have to say that what is moral is what God says is moral, and I think to remain internally consistent, they have to do that. And basically the result is that you any horrible thing can be moral as long as God says it is. The other alternative is to say that goodness exists separate from God, and so therefore God, probably can't be eternal in space and time. Otherwise he and morality would be the same thing. So basically the reason I like Satan is because God is a fucking authoritarian tyrant who says, hey, disobeying me, that's a sin. That's horrible. So I'm going to condemn you to a horrible existence because you disobeyed me. So Satan's like, fuck that.
But as a character, is he interesting?
Yeah. I think he's interesting in that he is actually treated like a character.
Yeah, there's that.
That's something that Milton does that I think is cool because the Bible and Christian teaching doesn't really do that. Like, he's just the embodiment of evil, and you don't ever see anything from his perspective. So the mere fact that we get to see things from his perspective is very interesting to me. And we get to see his motivations.
Yeah, I Well, I mean, just for background to what I'm going to, the thought that I'm going to try to have here, I didn't enjoy reading this at all, frankly. Like, I just found it, and I'm going to sound like a Philistine here. I tried to come up with some way to couch that or disguise that, but like, I would never ever read this again for pleasure, you know. And as I recall, I think it was my idea to bring it onto the podcast, so I don't have anybody to blame but myself here. But there's just a way that
it was Chris's idea.
It was my idea.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a big relief then. I'm not as much of a.
I'm the original sinner.
Right, right.
You're just the dude. You just have the penis.
Yeah, you're Satan. I'm Adam. But yeah, I just. What I was going to say is I was unable to appreciate it as an aesthetic piece, right? I really could not read it for the pleasure of reading it, right? And one thing that I found with the podcast is like, if you can just read, and not even with the podcast, I mean, something I learned in grad school is like, if you can just read something and enjoy reading it, then you can probably find something reasonably intelligent to say about it, right? If you can just engage with it in the way that you, if you're able to engage with it in the way that you would any other thing that you read for fun, then you can do okay with trying to discuss it with people. And
I
just, you know, the process of reading this, part of that was going, oh, I'm really not enjoying this, and part of it was just thinking like, I can't think of any remotely original observation or thought or perspective I could offer about this, right? Like, the question that I kept coming back to was like, something that is this, there's, it's like paradoxically incredibly well known and entrenched in the culture and also very alien at the same time, right? It's this thing where like the plot, the ideas, there's this idea of it that you have going into it that makes it very difficult to approach it as a work. And then at the same time, it's coming from this, to me, incredibly remote place in terms of the morals, the aesthetics, the kind of cultural, the religious value of it, right? And the sort of aesthetic scheme of it. And one thing that I was wondering was like, one of the received ideas that I have about this poem, and I did read it in grad school. When I say I read it, it was more that like I memorized some talking points about it in case I had to discuss it.
Was it on the MA list?
It was, yeah. Yeah.
It was? Okay. I never read it.
Well, we didn't read it. I think one of us compiled a list of talking points in case it came up on the exam, and we handed it out to each other and memorized it 3 days before the exam, and then I don't think ever used the talking points. Right? So I tell people that I've read Paradise Lost, but in the sense that I haven't really, you know. But one of the received ideas that I have about it is the idea that Satan is the hero, right? And that this is like, you know, when you're trying to, you know, like I've taught a class on writing about literature. And one thing that a lot of people have to kind of get across when they're teaching writing about literature to undergrads, right? Or to, you know, underclassmen, is like, you, author intention is, it's the old author intention thing, right? Don't, especially with newer books, okay, like I know you can go out and find an interview where, you know, Don DeLillo says what this novel is about. That doesn't actually mean that you've solved it and you can move on, right? And the model that I've always used for that, and God, I don't know why I do this, because I'm sure that like college freshmen from some Alaskan village, this isn't going to mean anything to them. But the model I've always used is Paradise Lost, right? Because like everybody reads Paradise Lost as having Satan as sort of a heroic protagonist, and presumably that would repel Milton. That was not Milton's intention.
Right, right, yeah.
That misreading is one of the kind of creative, like it's the classic creative misreading, right? And I say all this as build up to like kind of agreeing with you, Chris, that I, upon reading it, I didn't feel any great attachment to Satan as like a interesting protagonist, right? Like he's just sort of this, I don't know. I didn't feel a lot of attachment to him as a heroic protagonist, but I'm having some trouble formulating why I didn't, I guess. I mean, you were talking, Chris, about there's a bit where Adam and Eve kind of say, well, after they've been kicked out of the garden, they say, okay, well, that sucks, but we're going to go on, you know, what can you do but go on? And there's a weird kind of parallel to that at the beginning when Satan is kind of having the famous realization of like, well, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, I guess, right? Like that's also in a weird way has that same kind of feeling of like, well, he's just kind of, I mean, this is where we are and we'll go on. There's some nobility in that, I suppose. But that's really the only kind of moment of sympathy that I had for him.
Yeah,
So you don't think God's a fucking tyrant, Hans?
Well, I do think, I do think God's a tyrant, well, yeah.
But that doesn't make Satan interesting.
Right, right. And like, I think, you can certainly derive some, I mean, like, obviously, you know, like, we could sit here and trash the you know, everything that is wrong about Christianity. We can sit here and trash that all day. But
let's do it.
But I, you know,
sounds like a fun podcast to me.
But I mean, I guess I'm trying to find a flowery way to restate the point that Chris just made, right? Which is that, like, just because we agree with Satan's perspective on God doesn't necessarily make him sympathetic in any more than sort of a basic way.
So, I didn't have this response to Satan. I agree that to say that he's like the heroic protagonist is a misreading. Like, if you actually think that Milton wanted that, then that's a misreading. I don't think it's like a misreading to find him sympathetic. It's just a response. But the question I have is I did find him interesting. You know, the mere fact that we get to see things from Satan's perspective, I found interesting. And I'm wondering, like, what about him is, you know, he's, you know, if I pick up any piece of character fiction and if it's well written, I'll probably find the character interesting.
Sure.
So what about him is, you know, any different than any other character in a piece of character fiction?
I'll say maybe his motivations are just too fundamental and unadorned by complicating, interesting internal contradictions. He's just not an interesting person.
Like, right. Okay.
His.
It's not complicated. And that's a fair criticism, I think.
That's another reason I kept seeing like Vin Diesel, like in a, it's like, you know, like you could redo this movie and it's just, or movie, you could redo this as a movie and just have like the Satan and all the, and it would be visually stunning and all of them would pour out of through a portal in the sky and land in this sort of this black chaotic nothing space. And they're all beaten up from getting the shit kicked out of them by Jesus. And like, they're, you know, just sort of all like glum and sad. And then it zooms in on Satan's face and he's looking around at this like shithole that he's been sent to. And he just looks all angry and he's got pissed off Vin Diesel face. And then he says like, well, better to rule here than serve up there. And that basically is book one. Like, right. You know, I mean, like, except for like what Hans said, zooming in on some of the really interesting characters that have accompanied him. And it made it feel like sort of weirdly modern, where like, I guess the Iliad also does this, but I really didn't like the Iliad very much when I tried to read it.
You fuck.
I know. God. I'm sorry. It's,
come on, like, guys.
But zooming in on each of these like like
you should give it a reread. It's super good.
I should.
Read the Robert Fitzgerald translation because it's so much more poetic than the shitty Robert Fagles translation, which is admittedly more literal, but fuck literality.
Let's, but zooming in on each of these, like these fallen angels, first Moloch, horrid king besmeared with blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears through the noise of drums and timbrels loud. I mean, it's like a... It feels like it's in slow motion. Like, look at his rippling muscles, and he still has, like, blood. You know, like, there's something amazing about it. But actually, like, what is happening is boring. Like...
No, sure.
Like, yeah, like, it's just these dudes who look all sad, and they're, like, mad about they got kicked out of heaven. They lost the battle. You know, like, and then... So, I don't know. Like, tell me I'm wrong, man. I maybe I'm missing something about it. And also, like, what is Satan's goal? Is he trying to, is he just trying to mess with God? I didn't get how like going, I missed how doing, going to Earth or going to the Garden of Eden and doing what he's doing is going to do anything other than like populate mankind and hell with mankind.
God loves humans. Like he made humans to love him, and then and that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to ruin humanity for God.
But I
wanted to respond. We can move on from this. I just wanted to say one thing, Chris. Let's not forget that this is a poem, and while I agree that like nothing interesting is necessarily happening, you know, a big part of any poem is its use of language and the images it creates. And I think it's fair in a poem to be concerned, maybe even more concerned with how what the images look like and to make them feel fresh and vibrant, as opposed to always worrying about narrative tension.
It's interesting.
But that being said,
it's interesting that our instinct is almost to treat it like a novel, right? There's like a confusion of goals that were experienced in how we came at this thing. And I don't know if maybe part of that does actually come from, you know, it does have like a very kind of vivid cinematic quality. And like we have this whole, it has a very vivid cinematic quality, but we've kind of trained ourselves in our relationship to other media to say, well, okay, you can look good, but you got to have a story too, right? It's like it's interesting that there's a set of aesthetic standards almost based on like how you would judge a film, Chris, that you've kind of either consciously or subconsciously applied to this 500-year-old religious poem.
I think, yeah, I have like a short circuit in my brain when I think about this book or this epic poem because of everything that I really latched onto being visual. Mm-hmm. And nothing, it was very hard for me. I think the things that I really thought were interesting were either theoretical, if we were to like analyze like the philosophical like implications of this, you know, what is like, those all felt like they were things that were sort of around like looking at Satan as a hero feels like something that's not really in this necessarily. It's something that we've sort of applied to it.
Agree.
Like what can, you know, thinking about God as like omniscient, omnipresent, and yet functioning in a sort of a causal relationship to everything that he like theoretically controls, where it's like, well, you fucking broke the rules that I created that I knew you were going to break.
Yeah.
So you know, those are all very interesting, but it's like,
it doesn't convincingly. Well, there are, there are certain paradoxes that are inherent to Christian theology that I don't know if, I mean, I guess I'm not, there are certain paradoxes that are inherent to Christian theology, and it doesn't really resolve any of those. And if you, and it presents a lot of opportunity to think about those, but if you think about those, it kind of dissolves the foundation of the work as a narrative, right? So it's very flawed in that regard. I mean, I guess again, we're judging it as, without even kind of meaning to, I've slipped back into judging it as a narrative work, right? As a narrative work, it's built on intellectually flawed foundations that kind of destroy its ability to work as a narrative character piece. Again, other than, you know, maybe the thrill of you have a tyrant and you have a kind of agent of chaos who's trying to put a stick in the spokes of the tyrant's bicycle, you know. And I guess that is thrilling on its own terms. Yeah. Sorry, I lost the thread a little bit there, but
what if
is there?
I wanted to ask, maybe this is moving off topic or something, but if we think of this as a narrative, what do we think about the fact that it's not told in order? So the first book is Satan and his band arriving in hell, and then him going off to find this new world that God has then created. And then we skip back to God creating that world, and we actually see the battle between Satan and heaven, and then we go forward again. Is there something to that? And also, it seems like often Milton refers to gods of future, future people. And it also seems like the world is already populated before Adam and Eve leave Garden of Eden. So I don't know how much of that is, I don't know. What do we think of anything of this? Is that related to what you were saying, Hans?
I don't know if it's related to what I was saying necessarily. I mean, my instinct is to write it off as, I guess there are kind of two things happening there, right? One is a way in which the events are being told a little bit out of order for kind of, I assume, for artistic or dramatic effect. And I think reasonably effectively as such, right? You mentioned earlier, Chris, that he has a talent for set pieces, right? And the changing of the order has the effect a little bit of kind of staggering and pacing the set pieces in a way that's aesthetically effective, right? So that's one aspect of it, right? Is that it's told out of order in a way that actually feels, to my knowledge at least, a little bit ahead of its time, right? The deviation from just a strict chronological order, that's a pretty common artistic technique in let's say a novel from the 20th century. And the way that it's used here is for kind of pacing and momentum's sake, and is actually very, very creative and maybe a great, in its own way, a great innovation that I wouldn't necessarily have thought to praise if you hadn't thought about it that way. But then the other side of it, the demons all sitting around the table, and you know, the demons are all sitting around the table, and it kind of sounds like they've already been up, you know, getting humans to worship them, even though humans haven't been created yet, right? That kind of
right.
A chronology. I don't know my first instinct is just to kind of write that off as carelessness, maybe. I guess you can write it off as carelessness, or you can assume that it has It makes me think a little bit of like when I took a class on Shakespeare in grad school, and when the instructor talked about Hamlet, there are certain things in Hamlet where, you know, like the length of time since the father died. How long has it been since the king died in Hamlet, right? That the number shifts significantly from one part of the play to another without any indication that much time has actually elapsed, right? And maybe that's meant to suggest that Hamlet is losing his grip. Maybe that's meant to sort of evoke a weird sense of like ghostly, surreal timelessness. Or maybe Shakespeare was just in a hurry and fucked up, right? And there's, right. Because of the profile that work has, the assumption now is that they're, because of the profile that work has, I mean, I guess to some extent, if you're going to write off author intention, then, you know, you, in the absence of like Shakespeare, you know, unless we find an interview with Shakespeare where he's like, yeah, I fucked up in Hamlet. I kept saying the wrong amount of time since the king died. Whoops. In the absence of that, right, and which it's fortunate that we don't have that. There's no reason, I mean, if it creates a good artistic effect to have that kind of disjointedness, then we can say that that's something that is there for artistic effect, right? It's almost the same kind of thing with the sort of chronological slip-ups in Paradise Lost, where, like, if we assume that those have an artistic effect and aren't just, you know, a blind guy improvising a poem to his daughter, then
over the course of 7 years, which means he probably forgot a bunch of shit.
Right. But they do kind of have the effect of maybe of kind of suggesting that this is a story that plays out at some level beyond normal time, right? If that makes sense. I don't know. I think he just fucked up.
Sure.
I set out to describe some sort of frame in which that could be appreciated as an artistic device. But then by the time I was done, I had talked myself out of it.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I had a question. I'll ask it after you go, Patrick, but, what you're saying about, that sort of like when we don't know what the author intended, it gives us freedom to sort of like think about, you know, like how we can sort of interpret or make meaning from these weird contradictions and things that stick out. And it just reminded me, I don't know if I ever told you guys about this book, but there's a really cool, it's a big coffee table book that probably not too many people bought because it is sort of a interesting but strange topic. And it's sci-fi apologia, I think, was a sci-fi user experience apologia. Mm-hmm. So basically, like, it was looking at the different UI interfaces that have appeared in different science fiction films and television series over the past, like, 50, 60, 70 years.
You don't have to say UI interface, because UI is also already user interface.
I know, PIN number. Fuck you. Okay. So, like, but the
ATM machine.
I know. But they basically, well, I mean, it could be an ass to mouth machine. You don't know that.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
But the whole idea is that they look at these user interfaces from different science fiction properties. And then they write basically like a couple pages about why it would be that way. And like a really, what is that Michael York science fiction film from the 70s where like they kill people?
Logan's Run.
Yeah, there's like a scene in there. Great movie. He's dialing into like this like sort of like Match.com. Or like Tinder. But it's like a dial and you have to like tune in like a potential like sexual match and it's like fuzzy on the screen. So like they write like a page about it saying like, well, maybe actually that's part of the user interface intentionally to create a sense of tension and drama around this extraordinarily easy, you know, like dating interfaces, you know, where like you don't have that sense of tension and drama, where you're like, oh, maybe I will like this person, you know, so you like really have to try to like tune in. And then you get bought in because like it's so too easy to swipe right on people and to just sort of like use apps like we use them today. So maybe in the future we actually make those apps harder to use intentionally to make the to reinsert drama into meeting other people. Anyway, it's a cool book. I had a copy at my old office at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But
that sounds like fun.
Yeah. Sorry, Patrick. You actually had something that you were gonna.
I think I forgot it.
I do. I have a. That's perfect. I have a question. So basically, like this book is as close to it's a very like foundation stone like piece for Western culture. Is there anything in this that resonates with you in some way where you feel like that lies close to the center of like. It doesn't have to be religious, but like the iconography, like the morality of it, the various morality, you know, sort of like lessons in it or whatever. Like, does any of this feel like some old story that is very deep in your mind that like is part of how you are the way you are? Like, does that make sense? Like, since this is kind of like a pseudo-religious text, it seems like it should lie for Western culture, even though I don't think the three of us are very religious. Like, is there anything in it that sort of resonates with us?
I mean, thematically, there's not much that, like, all my reactions to it are, you know, oh boy, look at how this is wrong. Like those are all my reactions to its thematic intent. That being said, this is my second time reading it, and I really enjoyed this second read. I think it's a fantastic poem, despite the fact that I agree with absolutely nothing in it.
Yeah, it's very skillfully done, but ultimately it just feels like a totally alien artifact. It's almost like it's like watching Birth of a Nation, right? Or what's the Nazi film, Triumph of the Will? It's like watching Triumph of the Will. Mm-hmm. Right, like you can appreciate it as a technical achievement, but it's coming from an ethical perspective and a cultural standpoint that's so completely alien that you're never, I at least I wasn't able to find any way to relate to it that wasn't Even trying to approach Milton or even trying to approach Satan as a protagonist. Yeah, I just wasn't able to find any way into it. I felt very distanced from it, very alienated from it.
Mm. What about Adam and Eve? Did you find anything interesting in them at all? I mean, they start out as... there's a lot of things that are complicated, I think, in... You know, Eve being basically an idealized, submissive figure. And I don't know, is there anything interesting in them at all? Or anything that, like...
I mean, I think the choice between, you know, it sounds corny, but, like, ultimately... So Eve comes to Adam and she's like, oh, man, I done fucked up. I ate the fruit. Fuck. And Adam is like, oh, fuck. So I can either stay with God or I can stay with you. And he's like, okay, I guess I'm going with you because I love you. It's corny, but I think it's actually interesting.
Yeah, yeah, there's something in it that resonates in a human way, I guess, that not a lot of other stuff does. And again, I haven't really identified it myself on reading it, but when you frame it that way, that is... It's an effective moment, even though I don't know if it's a decision that were really from, like, again, from the moral standpoint of the poem, I don't know if it's a sanctioned decision, right?
Right, like, from Milton's perspective, it's probably like, oh, you fucking moron, Adam.
Yeah.
You dumbass.
Yeah,
But from a human perspective, I totally get it. You would totally do something, like, you're faced with this choice, and, you know, you're like, okay, I guess I, it's hell without you, so I guess it's going to be hell with you, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting choice.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and I guess after they fight, and Eve seems to, there's something interesting, I think, like, Milton, when he doesn't want to implicate a character with too much, because the more you occupy the mind of a character, I mean, supposedly, this is what I understand, I think, like, what I've absorbed through osmosis about this poem, is the reason that you don't write from God's perspective is because you can't occupy that perspective for very long without basically showing your ass. You know, like, you have to occupy a less, you can't be in the omniscient. You can't even have God as, like, a side character for very long. You have to occupy a limited perspective in order to tell a story like this. But I think it actually plays itself out in a smaller way where, like, Eve is the one who first transgresses and has the long conversation with the serpent. And then Adam is just like, well, since you did it, you know? And so, like, Adam kind of has a little bit more of an elevated, less detailed sin attributed to him. Whereas, like, Eve has the more detailed sort of like transgression. We track sin through the lesser figure. Like, we track sin through the one who is able to carry more of the culpability. And it happens again when we kind of, like, after Adam and Eve fight and basically blame each other for the situation, Eve basically takes all the, like, as much of the blame onto herself as possible. And then, like, the following, like, sort of, like, stanza is just like, and Adam felt, you know, good, that, you know, he felt better, that she, you know, like, he felt he suddenly they were commiserated. And actually, like, I felt like Eve there is the most interesting. Like, she's just, like, she's thinking about blame, she's thinking about responsibility in a way that, like, that I felt was interesting as a character. But I, again, that's me kind of treating this like a narrative,
and it's also probably not Miltonian too, like, because in Milton's world, you know, Eve deserves the blame, you know, she is lesser than man. So yeah, like I said, I think all the responses I have to this are I find deeply interesting, but it's always counter to what Milton, you know, kind of wants you to have.
Yeah. It reminds me a bit of, been trying to find, here we go. It makes me think a bit of, what Blake says about Milton in Marriage of Heaven and Hell, right? That Milton was a true poet, and that Paradise Lost was of the devil's party without knowing it. And I have never totally understood that, right? I've never totally understood what he meant by that. But I guess, I mean, it seems like there's an effect that we keep encountering where there's an aim that Milton seems to be writing toward from his religious background, from his, you know, theological view on the material. There's an aim that he keeps trying to write toward, but like, the quality with which he writes keeps causing different effects almost in a subconscious way, right? Like, these characters keep being sympathetic when they're not meant to be, presumably partly because of the skill with which they're depicted, or because of maybe some kind of maybe subconscious sympathetic response that Milton is having that maybe is running contrary to his stated perspective on the characters and the material, right? That's the best I can make for an interpretation of the response Blake is having to this, right?
Just saying there's a fundamental kind of paradox that just can't be. If you're like the seed, like a crystalline seed at the center of, like, you know, that basically sort of like affects the shape of everything around
or
it.
That
being that, like,
no, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, being that, like, I think it is going back to kind of like why I keep thinking about this as a narrative, but like, showing causality in something that is like within kind of the scope of an all-powerful, omniscient God that controls causality. And so, and showing culpability and blame and showing like there's something that just can't be reconciled there.
There's
something at the center of this that can't be
partly that. I guess the idea that I'm getting more toward, and I don't know 100% for sure if I believe this or agree with it, right, but like the idea that I'm getting toward, or that I think Blake was trying to get toward in Marriage of Heaven and Hell, is more that like if the art of poetry is inherently humanistic and sympathetic, if you assume that poetry, that effective poetry, is humanistic and sympathetic and empathetic to the human experience, then,
yes,
then you have this doctrine. You have this very good poet who is trying to use poetry to express a doctrine which is in fact anti-humanist, unsympathetic, one-dimensional, but because he's using an instrument that is meant to express empathetic, sympathetic, humanist ideas, or to express things in that manner, the skill with which he uses the art must inevitably betray the goals he is trying to achieve. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's really well said.
And I'm, you know, I think that's probably the case. Unless are we, you know, I have to admit that I'm just kind of assuming that Milton isn't actually aiming for this kind of empathy that you're talking about, Hans. You know, I remember one time mentioning this to an undergrad lit professor, like the idea of Satan as protagonist of Paradise Lost, and the professor said, you know, it's an interesting take, but it you know, it's not what Milton believed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm just taking that as received opinion. Are we certain that, do we know for certain that that Milton isn't trying to complicate things?
Well, I guess you can't know anything like that for certain.
Sure.
That's not a very good response, I know, but I don't have the first idea. I mean, I'm profoundly unqualified to speak about this poem from anything other than,
yeah,
like,
I guess,
just a reader, I guess, response perspective.
I guess we would just need to do, you know, I would just need to do some research, but I imagine, I don't know.
We could find a Milton scholar and I'll friend them on Facebook and then never get a response.
Right, exactly. You know, that's the way it's a good plan. It's a good plan, I think. So, is there anything, any last thing we want to say, or should we talk about what we're going to talk about next time, or what do you gents think?
Let's talk about what we're going to talk about next time. How far are you guys in Heaven and Hell?
I've read about 2/3.
I'm about 1/3 of the way in.
I'm about 1/3 of the way in. We don't have to do that one. What do you guys think? Do you want to do something else?
I'm going to leave it to you guys because it's a choice between your pick, Chris, and your pick, Hans. But if I voted, I would say let's skip it just because.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but I really don't don't really see what's.
Yeah, there's not. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of room in it. I mean, you're further than I am, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of interpretive headroom in it. You know,
right? It right. Seem that's like what I. That's what I was getting at.
There aren't questions I'm having as a reader that I want to talk about. It would be honestly kind of hard for me to talk about it without being maybe unnecessarily critical of it, because it kind of, I don't know, there's just like a particular kind of work. The term that I keep coming back to is like struggle fiction, right? Like it's fiction about like,
yeah,
like, boy, it sure is cold and the sea is dark and we're all going to die. And just the kind of like
right.
human against the elements kind of stuff. You know, which I encountered,
and it doesn't seem to have much of a deeper layer than that.
Right. And I've also Chris, I think you sort of, this was sort of your pick, but I wouldn't mind just giving you a do-over. I mean, you asked Daryl for a recommendation, and maybe now we're gonna politely decline Daryl's recommendation.
Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah. No, I'm fine. Paradise Lost was legitimately one that I've been meaning to pick. So that was my pick.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's your turn now.
Cool. Well, I actually have, I may regret this. I think I might like put my next three picks in stone, like sort of embark on a longer term project.
All right.
Are they related?
Yeah, they're thematically related, actually. So I got really interested in, I was just kind of thinking about like fiction that deals with gender and transgender experiences and complications of gender. And I was trying to find,
like the Mary Acker's short story collection a little bit?
That a little bit. What I was kind of interested in was like, how
Acrecock,
yeah. Yeah, what I was kind of interested, well, what I was initially interested in, so the thing that I was originally going to pick was have either of you read or heard of, or do you have any sense of the Gore Vidal novel? Oh, shoot. I have it on my bookshelf. I'm going to turn around and I can't. It's just a woman's name, so I can't remember the name. Hold on a sec. Myra Breckinridge by Gore Vidal.
I have no sense of it at all.
So it's a novel from the 60s about it's about a trans woman who is sort of portrayed as this marauding sociopath. And it's such an interesting. It's so interesting because in some ways it's very progressive in approaching, I mean, it's sort of like the, to my knowledge, one of the earliest like trans people in contemporary fiction. But then on the other hand, you know, the character is presented in this way that you can either read as unsympathetic, you know, it's hard to say how much, probably by like contemporary standards of representation, it's not the best, not the best portrait, right? But in some ways, it's still a very daring work. And it was actually very popular in its day. There was even a film adaptation, and it's completely forgotten now for the most part, from what I can tell. And so I really wanted to read that and talk about it. And it has a relatively short sequel, and I was torn between wanting to, I thought about maybe even seeing if we could read the book and the sequel, because together they're still quite short. But then I thought, well, shoot, if I'm going to do that, I guess, like, there are probably lots of contemporary novels that have, like, the stamp of approval of, like, if you Google, like, what's, you know, fiction that represents the trans experience that is someone who was trans would read it and go, okay, this is good representation, right? So I thought, well, maybe I should also try to find something like that and use that for another pick. And then I also, when I really started to think about gender in fiction being used in weird ways, it made me really, really want to bring in The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. So finally I thought, well, fuck it. I'll do Myron Breckinridge and then The Wasp Factory. And then the third book, I found something that is like, you know, something that is kind of a contemporary thing that kind of was written after the sort of level of attention now that we have to you know, trans experiences. I found that too, but I can't remember what it is, unfortunately. So my pick is, if you guys don't mind, for next week, Myra Breckinridge and then the sequel Myron by Gore Vidal. They are available in one volume. I have them in one volume, and the combined volume is like 300 pages maybe. So.
Oh, okay.
And I haven't read it for a couple. I probably haven't read it for 3 years. So sorry. Go ahead.
Myra Breckinridge and Myron.
Yeah.
By Gore Vidal.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Let's talk about it. All right. Cool. Excellent. As always, it's wonderful to talk to you guys. You know, we kind of had a strange one here with Paradise Lost.
I don't feel like I did
that
very
being
well.
Said, no, I thought, you know, for being totally uninterested in it, like I thought you, you know, I thought you had good comments.
I probably handled it better than Cormac McCarthy, at least.
No, you're fine in Cormac McCarthy too. Like the fact that you hated it, you know, didn't really register. Well, it I mean, I understood that you didn't like it, but you know, that didn't prevent us from having a decent conversation.
There you go.
Whereas, like when we talked about what was that New Zealand one?
Oh, Janet Frame, the Carpathians.
Oh man, yeah. Like I hated that so much. And in contrast, I felt like I did horrible. Like I was like, "Oh God, why did you do this to me, Chris? You screwed me so bad and I hated it and it sucked and I said that." Whereas you graciously responded, Hans. So
Right. Very good.
It's all good.
All right.
All right. Everyone, thank you for listening. We'll talk about Gore Vidal not next week, but next time. And until then, peace out. Thanks for listening.